Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Viriya Nair, who's going to talk to us today about teaching critical thinking as a part of spiritual practice. Hello, Viriya Nair. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hi.
Can you start by telling us a bit about your life and background, Viriya Nair?
Okay. Well, I studied philosophy, including logic, at university. So I have a good academic grounding in critical thinking.
Yeah.
Particularly in terms of formal logic, informal logic, philosophical style thinking. But later on, I came across Buddhism, and when I met my husband, Robert. And so it's been a very interesting journey for me because I've always had this philosophical, logical, critical thinking side. But of course, I've also had and developed more of the Buddhist side. And it's been a very interesting experience beginning to bring them together and now recently actually teaching critical thinking as a spiritual practice.
So in the Buddhist tradition, would you say that critical thinking is a discipline that's fundamental to the approach?
You couldn't say critical thinking as a discipline is fundamental to the approach, no. But it's certainly the case that in the Buddhist scriptures and also in the tradition, there is very much an expectation and an encouragement of clear thinking, of recognizing we might be wrong, of working things out, not just taking ideas on the authority of scripture. So I think calling it a discipline would probably be a bit too strong,
yeah,
or give an academic flavour which isn't appropriate.
So what term would you use? A practice?
Yes, a practice. Yes.
Okay. And why is that important for the philosophy within Buddhism to do that?
Okay. So Buddhism is about developing wisdom and loving kindness. It's about developing better, clearer, more positive mental states. Some of this, of course, is emotional or spiritual, ritual, physical, but some of it is intellectual as well.
Yeah.
And so thinking clearly comes into that spiritual practice.
Okay. Now, you are a sixth form teacher, is that right?
Yes, that's right. I teach A-level. I teach several different types, but one of them is critical thinking.
And how is critical thinking normally taught in a normal school environment?
Okay, so it's seen very much as an academic subject. So students learn how to dissect arguments, they learn how to make arguments, they learn about use of evidence, assumptions, that sort of thing. And it's seen as a decidedly cerebral subject. But interestingly, if you look at some of the publications, they do bring in spiritual qualities, definitely. But those are generally not followed up in the exam, certainly.
What do you think are the limitations with that approach?
Well, it's tricky because students are often exam focused. And so they tend to say things like, well, you know, this will this get me through the exam? Is this going to come up on the exam paper?
Yeah.
And though the qualities, for example, of fair-mindedness, of empathy, openness, readiness to sift the evidence, readiness to set aside one's prejudices, they're very much part of the course, but of course they're not explicitly examined as such.
Now, you've recently been given the opportunity to teach it as a spiritual practice. How did that come about, and what does that entail?
Okay, well, I should say, first of all, that I sort of was making this up as I went along. So if I do it again, I think I'll probably change it a bit. I'm a member of the Triratna Buddhist Order, and I was asked to teach some young women who've been doing this course, part of the training to join the order. And I was asked to teach critical thinking to them as part of the training course. So I'm used to teaching Buddhism, to exploring Buddhist practice, and I'm used to teaching critical thinking, but this was the first time I had the opportunity to bring them together. So for me, that's very exciting. So what I did was I led the students through the sort of very basic steps of critical thinking, like looking at arguments, being clear about what people are saying, that sort of thing. But then quite quickly, I linked them to cognitive biases. So that's where very often when we're trying to think, we have our own biases, which predispose us to look for a particular outcome rather than trying to see the evidence as it really is.
Yeah.
And this links in very well with the idea in Buddhism of you're developing clear mental states.
Okay.
So one of the functions of Buddhism is to develop clear and positive mental states.
Okay. Well, just to clarify terms, what do you mean by spiritual practice?
Okay, well, that's a tricky phrase, isn't it? I mean, people have lots of different interpretations of it. I guess my interpretation is a practice, which could be intellectual practice, an emotional practice, a physical practice, any sort of practice, which helps to develop greater levels of integration, of positivity, of clarity.
Okay.
So I interpret it very broadly, but I do think it's important that it's a practice. It's not something you like the idea of. It's something that you actually do.
So in practical terms, how does the focus differ teaching critical thinking as a spiritual practice from the more traditional one?
Okay. So when I was teaching critical thinking as a spiritual practice to these young women, we started every class with a short meditation on loving kindness.
Yeah.
And the reason for this is spiritual practice, obviously you're wanting to develop loving kindness. And critical thinking can be challenging. It can be challenging to one's own self-view. And because you're often criticizing other people's arguments, it can get quite sharp sometimes. And people can get quite argumentative. So I thought it was really important to start with a loving kindness practice,
yeah,
where you encourage loving kindness towards yourself, but also towards others. And then when I was teaching them some of the logical flaws, like the flaw ad hominem, where you attack a person personally rather than their argument, which is a classic logical flaw. This is also, of course, from a spiritual point of view, a negative activity, because it's very important to be able to separate out one's response to an individual and one's response to their argument. So it's obviously quite damaging spiritually to completely identify somebody with their argument.
Yeah.
And then if you disagree with their argument, it's easy to demonize them and see them as the enemy rather than seeing them as somebody, a whole human being with whom you disagree about something.
That just seems to make so much sense. Would that be impractical in a sixth form environment to do that?
I don't start with a meditation. I mean, I quite like to, but I do, when we're talking about ad hominem, I do say, I don't use the word spiritual, but I do say, obviously, this is better for one to do in life, you know.
Yeah.
And the students do get that. But a fair amount of this is about emphasis.
Okay.
How much time do you spend on it? How much do you emphasize it?
Yeah. You just mentioned a term you used was logical flaw, or I think the other term is logical fallacy.
Yeah.
How is a logical flaw related to a cognitive bias?
Okay. So very often, for example, there's a logical flaw called the straw man. And this is where you distort your opponent's argument in order to attack it.
Yeah.
You make it weaker. So people, for example, who don't like being a member of the European Union, so it might say something like, oh, if you're in favour of the European Union, this is because you want to be run by Germany. Right? Now, that's a straw man, because it's not the case that everybody who's in favour of the European Union wants to be run by Germany. It's just wrong. But if you distort somebody else's argument, you make it easy to attack. And then you can say, well, I don't want to be owned by Germany, therefore, you know, I'm against the European Union. But of course, that's not a good, it's not a good state of mind to be in. Now, sometimes people use straw men deliberately. It's quite a deliberate attempt, politicians do this, to distort their opponent's argument in order to attack it. But very often, people do it unconsciously. They get the wrong end of the stick. They hear something that the other person hasn't said. And that's because they've got cognitive bias, they've got a negative mental state, and they're not able to hear what the other person says in a clear and unbiased way.
Okay.
So it can work both logical flaws. If you recognize logical flaws, then you can recognize the negative mental state that goes with it. Or you can put it the other way around. If you can recognize your negative mental state, then you're in a much better position to recognize logical flaws. So one of my students said to me that the third afternoon when we'd been studying critical thinking and spiritual practice, she came back and told the group that the previous afternoon, after we'd finished the class, she'd been in a negative mental state and she'd be feeling cross and, you know, but she was aware she was in a negative mental state. And then she realized, because we'd been studying this, that in fact it was a straw man. She was working with a straw man.
How interesting.
She distorted somebody else's argument. And she told us that as soon as she recognized that, the negative state disappeared.
Right. Okay.
It was just a question of labeling it.
Yes.
Seeing what the problem was, and then she saw it as physically.
And this really ties in with the idea of it being a spiritual practice. So it's something that not only can help you in an argument, but can help you find balance in your own mental states.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned this a bit earlier. There is a perception that critical thinking is very cerebral. How do you get around this?
Yeah, certainly there is that perception. And it's not false in as much as it is intellectually demanding. With critical thinking, you're not learning facts. You can't just learn facts and regurgitate them. It's not a question of learning other people's theories. You have to learn a method, a skill. But then for me, spiritual practice is a skill too, so the two are closely linked. You have to learn these skills and then you apply them. And it's not particularly easy. So in that sense, it's true that it is cerebral. I think the misapprehension is that it's just cerebral or it's just intellectual. When you teach it correctly, when you approach it correctly, it's very rich.
Yeah.
So it's cerebral and emotional and indeed can lead to spiritual benefits. But there isn't an easy way in some respects. You have to put a bit of effort in. There's just no way around that one. That's certainly true.
I interviewed someone called Peter Worley recently from the Philosophy Foundation, and they're teaching philosophy, but as you know, critical thinking is a fundamental part of philosophy, and they're teaching it to children from an early age. And so he suggests that they are building the skills of argumentation and looking out for these logical flaws from an early age, that it becomes quite natural. Do you think if you did that, then you would lose that stigma of it being cerebral, and that, you know, rather than it being something you just do at sixth form and you have to jump through a lot of hoops in that sense?
Definitely. Absolutely, definitely. I think everybody should learn it from primary school. Now, with my own daughter, I haven't taught her formally, but she has learnt critical thinking as she's gone along. And for her, it's just been part of her general education. And I'm very much in favour of doing it at primary school. The main difficulty would be either you'd have to get specialists coming to visit primary school, or you'd have to retrain the entire primary school teaching cohort, which would be quite demanding.
What's the reaction been from the group that you've been teaching?
Oh, it's been very positive. Their main feedback was that we didn't have long enough on it, which was true. They wanted to see perhaps more precise links between spiritual practice, between critical thinking and Buddhist teaching, which for that group would be fair enough. But you could teach it as a spiritual practice to people who weren't Buddhist.
Yeah.
And so that would be fine. You just need slightly different labelling. There'd be certain things you emphasise rather than other things. But it's absolutely the case that you can use critical thinking as a spiritual practice without being Buddhist. No question.
Okay, well, that seems to be happening now, doesn't it, in schools?
It does.
Yeah. Another perception that that seems to be around with it, that it's a male subject. To what degree would you agree with that?
Okay, there is. I think that's true to some extent. But I mean, I actually have more girls than boys. But when I used to do critical thinking to A2 instead of just AS, I used to get more boys in second year. I think there is a bit of perception. There is this view that logic, formal reasoning, is more male, and empathy and sort of touchy-feely stuff is more female.
Yeah.
There may be some truth in that. I don't want to completely dismiss that. But what isn't true, what definitely isn't true, is that women can't learn critical thinking because they really, really can, or that men can't learn empathy because they really, really can.
Yeah.
But also there's this view, and I've met this as well among Buddhists, which I think is unfortunate, that if you approach things logically and if you have that as one of your modes of thinking, that that means you're less kind in some way, or you're less warm, or you're less empathetic. Now, that is just completely false, because one's capacity for empathy, for understanding, for engaging with other people is enhanced by critical thinking, not diminished. So that is the main myth which I really, really want to scotch. Clear thinking, intellectual thinking, logical thinking is an enhancement to understanding, to awareness, to empathy, and to love. It is not an opposition.
Not the other way around. Okay. What is your understanding of the middle way, Bree and I?
Okay. Well, obviously, this is a rich term. So for me, the middle way is very much about being aware of where you are, being aware of where you're going, what you're aiming towards, but also holding them both simultaneously. So one of my practices is the practice of equanimity, upekkha, equanimity. So this is where you're aware of joy, you're aware of sorrow, you feel it, but you're not overwhelmed by it. So for me, it's an important practice. But it's a difficult practice. So for me, it's very important to have that as an aim, but to be aware of where I am at the moment, what I can do, what I can't do, and keep that flexible feeling around where I am. So the middle way, I'm moving, I'm changing, but I'm aware of what my current capacity is.
Okay. And how does what we've been talking about today relate to the middle way?
Part of the middle way, of course, is getting greater clarity, greater awareness of where you are at the moment. Yeah? And critical thinking, of course, is a great help to clarity and awareness. And my motto when I'm teaching critical thinking, either to Buddhists or to A-level students, comes from Socrates, a Greek philosopher, who said, "When I find I've made a mistake, I'm happy. Because that means I'm wiser today than I was yesterday." And I really love that quote. Because you're saying, I'm not perfect, but if I find I've made a mistake, then I can learn from it. And that's very critical thinking, but it's also very middle way.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much for that, Verena. It's been really interesting. Thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.